They know nothing about me. I've never been arrested. I don't have a criminal record. I mean, if I took a police check that time, they'd think, oh, what a bright boy, what a great future he's got. Because I've never been in trouble.
How did a young man with a bright future go from wanting to be a lawyer to being imprisoned for gang-related activity within just 18 months?
You know, all those classic psychological hooks that pull young people into gangs, it was all of those. I was looking for that protection.
How were violent criminals able to target and exploit young people?
They're not my friends. Since I've been here doing this 9-year sentence, not one of them came to see me.
And what signs should parents, social workers and teachers be looking out for?
So if your child is coming home and they've got 2 or 3 mobile phones, no, question that.
Francis Assay Appiah of Reform Restore Respect joins me on the latest Police and Crime podcast.
So 16 years ago, as a young teenager, you were a very bright academic student in the Tottenham area of North London. However, you didn't want to be the smart kid who was bullied and rebelled and turned to the gangs to find a sense of belonging and status. What was it that caused that? Because it's not something that I've seen before, you know, being bright, very academic, but turning to the gangs instead. So what caused that, and what was it that you felt that gangs offered instead?
Interestingly, because I wasn't born here, I was born in Ghana. And my parents were here, my dad was here from 1966, and my mum joined my dad in the 80s. So I was living in Ghana with my grandmother. So that attachment with my mum, dad wasn't there, so I had my nan. So when I was 7, they decided to bring me to the UK to join them, so I can go to school here and we can all become a nuclear family again. So when I came to the UK, is that transition. I had to learn to speak English, new environment, new country. And I really struggled, and the kids just bullied me at primary school, early stage of secondary school. You know, they said, why does your hair look like that? And I couldn't speak English language. And yeah, it was really difficult. And through all that bullying, when I went home, because I come from a really big family, I wasn't able to tell my parents what was going on with me at school either. Sort of bottled it all inside. So I think when I left school really late in my teens, it just came out sideways. And the gangs got hold of me. I was groomed by the leader of the gang, Mark Lambie. Very dangerous individual who I knew nothing about until I was in the courtroom with him. That's when his history came up. And I was like, whoa, this is the people I got myself mixed up with. You know, so that's how it happened. And so I turned to the gangs for safety, protection, you know, all those classic psychological hooks that pull young people into gangs. It was all of those. You know, I was looking for that protection. And being in the gang, standing next to that individual, Mark Lambie, it made people leave me alone. Like, oh my gosh, Francis knows that individual. We can't touch him above him no more. So that's what I was seeking, but they had other plans for me.
No, was there a starting point for all of this? Was there one trigger or what? You know, you mentioned this guy, but were there others who were doing the work for him in order to try and make offers? I mean, we hear today about offers of cash and favours being given to young people. I mean, what was their recruiting methods like?
So the recruiting method for him was, I think he saw me growing up as a young boy on the council estate in North London where my parents lived. So he knew me. He's probably spotted me from a very early stage. He used to greet me, hello France. They used to call me footballer because football was my life. I always had football under my arm with my rucksack going to school. No, always playing football. They used to call me footballer or bowler. And I waved to him, and then from that, it progressed. £10 there, £20 there. And it got to the point where I had to call him Uncle Mark, because I'm still a teenager. He's in his life, 30s. You know, I used to refer to him as Uncle Mark, and I really liked this guy, but I couldn't see what he was building up. I mean, at that age, to be honest with you, if I heard the word grooming, I associate the word grooming with paedophiles and sexual offenders. I didn't think grooming was used by gangs like that, you know, and I didn't even understand it.
Yeah.
And then it was clothes, Armani jeans, trainers, and that big favour came, look after this parcel of drugs. Don't tell no one, don't tell your parents, don't tell no friends. And I kept my mouth shut because he's given me so much gifts prior to that.
Yeah. And was that the gateway? Was that the first time it started to escalate into more sort of criminal activity? And, so, I mean, what was the interaction with the police like? Was it, were you caught at that point, or, you know, how did it escalate from there on until you were involved with police?
So the police are still They don't know nothing about me. I've never been arrested. I don't have a criminal record. I mean, if I took a police check that time, they'd think, oh, what a bright boy. What a great future he's got. Because I've never been in trouble. So it was like that. And then Mark Lambie taught me how to sell drugs for him. Like, Francis, if you weigh this drug, 0.2 weighs that, it's 20 pounds, 0.3 weighs this. He taught me the whole weight and how much it's worth. So he was giving the drugs, I was selling it, paying him back, and it's got bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where they even gave me all their guns to hide in my parents' house for him. And it was like, I was just the perfect child, perfect family, Christian-based family, we're Catholics, church-going family, none of us are criminals. So I was just the perfect family setup that police would never suspect. And I guess now looking back, that's why I was targeted by him. And then I gave up. I did my GCSEs, I did my A-levels, and I said to my parents, I'm not going to university. I'm giving up on my education. I was with him full time. He was driving me around from North London to South London to West London. He was taking me to other gang that he controlled in those areas. And I mean all these gang members. Some of them I don't even know, but as long as I'm moving, I felt safe. And then, yeah, that's when it started. And all of this took to courtroom in the Old Bailey, took 18 months.
That's quite a quick, very quick escalation.
So the intervention couldn't get in, or anyone couldn't spot that to help me. So it all happened very quick.
And there was nothing that would have either sort of turned your head away from it, or that any sort of teachers or social workers could have spotted to?
No, because my family or myself, we were deemed as the perfect family, I was a bright boy, all the signs were missed. My parents spotted the signs though, because now I'm going home wearing a lot of designer clothing, I'm wearing a Rolex watch, and like, Francis, you work in Sainsbury's Home Base, where did you get this stuff from? Are you hanging around with those boys outside? Are they turning you? And, oh, Mom, you talk too much. Dad, you talk too much. I was so naive and I had a chip on my shoulder. I think now I'm Mr. Big because I'm hanging around with him, And even then, I still used to sneak out my parents' house to go out to hang around with him and sneak back through the emergency exit or the flat and pretend I've got... So when my parents wake up, they think I'm in bed. But throughout the night, I'm out hanging around with them. So it was like a double life I was leading. I tried to portray one way to my parents because I know they will never agree with my lifestyle. And then when I moved them, I'm portraying another lifestyle. And it was just all very confusing as well. And it did happen very quick. 18 months, it all happened. And I was in the Old Bailey facing a very serious case. And you know what? I take off my hat to the Met Police at the time as well. It was Trident. They did everything they could to pull me back out of that case. So Francis, we don't want to criminalise you. You are not a criminal. But you have to give Queen's evidence. That's your only way out. You have to give evidence for the Crown. And we will drop every charge on you. At the moment, we've got you on joint enterprise because we know you were with them. Mm. And I still wouldn't do it. They came to visit me in prison. They went to my parents' house. Please try and convince Francis to give evidence for the Crown so we can drop the charges on him. Otherwise, he's going to go to prison. He's going to have a criminal record. And I still wouldn't do it. I had this loyalty to them. I thought they were my friends. Yeah, it's really sad. And then every prison I went to, when I was in prison, a lot of prisons, and I met prison officers, they always said to me, son, what are you doing in here? I'm like, what do you mean, what am I doing in here? I'm in prison. So you're not a typical prisoner. There's something about you. Mm. Your mannerism, the way you talk. You're not a prisoner that we see every day.
Sure.
And you should not be in here. I kept on hearing that all the time. And I think, again, that kicked me up on the backside to approach the education department. So, look, I've got GCSEs, I've got A-levels. Can I actually do my degree from prison? Mm. I said, of course you can.
And what was your sentence? So you've escalated from your first involvement. You're in the courtroom, your sentence. Yeah. How long was the original?
So I was given 9-year sentence.
Yeah.
And they were given 12 years and 11-year sentences.
Okay.
And I think the judge differentiated me and them by saying, as long as you behave yourself, get your head down, I recommend you get early release, parole first time. And he didn't make that recommendation for them. So as long as I got my head down in prison, I knew I'll get out as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So while I was doing the 9 years, probably 4 years into it, they came back and rearrested all of us again for a case that was pending. And that was a murder case.
Mm. Was it linked to things that the group had been involved with before?
Yeah, it's the same gang. So the one that I'm doing 9 years for happened April 2001, and this pending one happened June 2001. So just a few months in between them, but it was unsolved and it was just pending. So while we were in, convicted now, a new case law came out, the case of Bradley, which was for the first time now prosecution can tell the jury if you're back in court on trial for something similar that you've already got a pass for, that so-and-so got a conviction for kidnapping, blackmail or drugs. They're now allowed to tell the jury that. And that became case law. And so that, I think that's why they approach all of us,
sure,
bring us back. And now they can tell the jury, Diesel already in prison for kidnapping a fellow drug dealer. And that murder case was a kidnapping that led to a murder. So they linked it like that. And then now I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what have I got myself caught up in? I'm doing 9 years. I'm nearly there. I'm about to get pro to go home. And now I've been just been picked up again with all of them again, back at Old Bailey again. I'm going through, I'm thinking, am I ever going to get out of prison? Is that 9 year sentence going to turn into a life sentence? I'm really stressed, you know, it's pulling my hair out. And then they decide to give us a plea bargain that if we plead guilty to a lesser charge of forced imprisonment, which we're already serving time for, they'll drop the murder charge and enter a not guilty plea, like we've been found not guilty by a jury. So none of the group can ever be arrested, can get arrested again for that murder case. And I'm like, I'm not doing it. I don't want a plea bargain. I'll do whatever it takes. This time round, I will give evidence for the Crown. Because I've now learned my lesson. I've grown up now.
Good.
I'm not doing it. And then the gangs start knocking on my parents' house in North London. If France don't take that deal, we're going to shoot up the house. If France don't take the deal, we're going to do this to your family members. And it was pressured. I'm not doing it. My parents are like, are you sure? I'm not taking it, Mum. I've had enough. They're not my friends. Since I've been here doing this 9 year sentence, not one of them came to see me. So now I learned the hard way. So now it's come back around again. I'm being stubborn about it. I don't care they get life sentence for murder, but I'm not taking no deal to help them out. So I'm sticking to my guns. And at the end, I caved in the last minute. And I took that plea bargain with them for them to get off murder case. And they upped my sentence from 9 years to 16 years. So now I'm not getting out of prison on parole. And I guess sometimes I'm a great believer that things happen for a reason. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm not supposed to be getting out of prison or get released. So now my release date has gone from 2016 to 2010. A longer stretch.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to me. And I guess that's why I've never met any of these individuals again. There's a big Chinese wall between me and them. Because I hold very strong feelings against them. Because what happened to me, and the whole bullying and pressuring me in court, intimidation. And sometimes I feel like it was a bit of a duress as well, but yeah, I can't stand them.
If you can provide a first-class service protecting and serving the people of Kent.
If you will put the public first and deliver a service to be proud of.
If you will serve with integrity and professionalism.
If you will protect the public from harm and ensure an effective response to those who are most vulnerable in our communities.
If you will treat everyone with fairness, respect and dignity.
If you will be innovative, use resources wisely and operate as one team.
If you will act with humility, compassion and courtesy.
If you will listen, learn and strive to improve.
If you will deliver an efficient and effective service that represents value for money.
If you will provide visible, local policing at the heart of our policing model.
If you will always put victims and witnesses first.
If you will tackle crime and antisocial behaviour.
If you will meet our national policing commitments.
If you will develop yourself and support our committed workforce.
Then you will be a fine Kent police officer. And I, the Chief Constable, want to hear from you.
Find out more at kent.police.uk/jobs.
And obviously you mentioned that, you know, that was the point at which you said, you know, no more. You'd already considered making approaches to the Department for Education.
Yeah.
Within the prison. Not many people leave prison with a degree, I understand.
No,
and you did. You know what? You went on to complete your studies, but how did you go about doing that? How did you find the process of engaging with prison education, and how did you end up with the degree that you did?
While I was in there, I saw a lot of people come in and out, that vicious cycle. and it's like Christmas. The same people get out, but they come back in time for Christmas. And I'm looking at these individuals, I'm thinking, I just want one chance to get released, because I know I'll never see a prison again. I just want that chance. I'm not getting that chance. And these individuals just keep in and out, in and out, in and out. So I started doing my degree. I want to better myself. I think I did a full cycle. People say to me, how come I can do what I'm doing? Work in a school, set up a charity, and other ex-offenders can't do what I'm doing. And what I normally say to that is, I've always had these attributes. This is how I was raised. These were my foundation by my parents. So all I've done a reverse, gone back the other way and just picked up all those foundations that my parents embedded in me. This is who I should be. I should have been a lawyer, a barrister in court, defending people. That was my dream job. And I didn't achieve that dream. So everything I'm doing now, I say to people, of course I can do it. I had the ability to do it, but I made one mistake by getting involved in a gang. And 18 months, that gang turned my life upside down. So when I started doing that degree, I mean, I loved it. And now you know about academic studies as it is. You know, it's very addictive as well. Yeah. And I wanted more. As soon as I finished one module, I was doing 60 yeah. points per year. It's trying to accumulate 360. So I want the honors after my name.
Yeah.
No, I could have stopped at 300 points. No, I want the whole 360. And I just look forward to getting my new set of books arriving for the new course. And I just loved it. And in fact, the first year I started, I wrote to Lord Wolf at the time. I think he's retired now. He was a high court judge. And I wrote to him. I said, look, I want to do this course. Can you fund me to do this course? Because he was a patron for the Prison Education Trust at the time, Lord Wolf. He said, yep, I'll pay for your first year. So, as long as you pass, we funded for you every single year to finish that degree.
And that must have made a massive difference to your confidence and your
lifted me.
Your morale going forward and engaging in the study.
It lifted me, Matthew. And the first year I got a distinction.
Brilliant.
I got a distinction and there's no distractions. I can't go out partying. I can't go clubbing. I'm locked in this for 22 hours a day.
Yeah.
What the best way to study? I don't want to go to the gym like what other prisoners do. Come out with big bulky muscles. Those muscles ain't going to get me a job. You know, I'm not interested in what other prisoners are doing, fighting and up to no good, selling drugs in there. I said, get locked up in my cell. And because I was doing that degree, they always make sure, the prison service make sure I always had a single cell. So I'm not sharing no one because I'm studying. And I just cracked on with it year by year. And in my final year, when I got released on parole and good behavior, I had one more 60 point to do. So I did that 60 point after my release and graduated in April 2010. And I came out with a degree.
It's fantastic. I mean, it's an inspirational story as well. And you know, the way in which you stuck with it, you were looking forward to the teaching and the work itself. I mean, was it health and social care you did?
Health and social care.
And yeah. and does that now play a role in what you do with the charity and with
West Heath School? Yeah. So I'm the head of residential care of West Heath School. So yeah, I'm working with it still. But before I went to West Heath School, I was the residential care manager at Pepinbury in Pembury, Comfort Lane, Tunbridge Wells. Mm. They've now merged, now called Aspen's Charity. So I started as a support worker, and the CEO there, Roger Gibson, kept on promoting me every year, kept on promoting me to right to management. And I worked for them for about 8 years. And after 8 years, I thought, you know, I've done this adult learning disability care, I've the CQC. I want to get the Ofsted under my belt. And that's when I went to West Heath School. So it's the same role, transferable skills, but now it's children's care at West Heath. And now I'm getting Ofsted as well. So I've got a whole lot. And then it helps with the charity, because now the charity are going to schools. So it's all Ofsted, it's all children umbrella that I'm working within. And it's perfect. You know, it's really good. I'm glad I studied that degree. And it's one of those degrees you can branch off as well and do other stuff with it. Say I want to go into social work, go into probation, counselling, teaching. I can just branch off and do whatever I want to do with it.
And as part of, did that inspire your work to with the school? So you set up the charity after, how long after you left prison did you set the charity up?
So I left prison 2010 and I set the charity up 2 years later, 2012. Yeah.
So you've been going now for 6 or 7 years now.
7 years, yeah.
Making a difference to hundreds and thousands of kids' lives. You know, how did you go about starting the project? Did you do it alone? Did you work in conjunction with other people?
Well, I got a business mentor who's now become a trustee and our treasurer, Ian Ross. Ian Ross met me in Feltham when I was on remand for the case. So his charity called Outside Chance. So we are now like sister, brother charity type thing. So everything that Reform, Restore, Respect is carbon copy of Outside Chance in West London. So I met Ian in 2001, 2002. He came into Feltham to deliver a workshop, crime workshop. The prison officers opened myself. Right, do you want to go along to this talk? I said, no, I don't really want to. He said, no, you might like it. It'd get you out of your cell. So I went along. I met this Scottish guy. I took one look at him. I thought, oh, probably a police officer undercover. Probably a Trident officer. And then he opened his mouth. He started talking. I said, wow, he just grabbed me. He's got one of those voices. He just grabs you. And I loved everything that he was saying. So at the end, I purposely stayed behind to shake his hand. It's a great talk. You know, it made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
And he said to me, son, you're in here now. Best thing you can do is just educate yourself so you don't ever come back in here again. So that was it. I didn't see this man again. So when I came out in 2010, I went to a conference in London and I bumped into Ian. He didn't even remember me, but I remembered him. That's
such a lasting impact, isn't it?
Impact, impression he made on me. I said, Ian, I'm out. I met you in Feltham because I meet hundreds and thousands of kids, Francis. I don't really remember you as well. I was in at that particular time, year 2001, you came in. I said, I want to do what you do, but the difference, I think I'll be better than you. I told him, I said, I think I'll be better.
They did instill some confidence in you then.
Yeah. I said, I'll be better than you, Ian.
I've heard of competition in the charitable sector, but that's something.
So I want to do what you do, but I think I'll be better than you. And he laughed. He goes, you probably will, because you've lived it. I've not lived it. You know, so you probably be better. That's right. Take my card. My office is in Hammersmith. Call me, let's set up a meeting, come along, and I'll help you set up your charity. So I went along, met him. I had a business plan drawn up. He looked at the business plan, and he just binned it. I said, this is not good enough, Francis. I've been in the charitable world for like nearly 20 years. No funder will get you started with this. You know, your ambition is too big. You know, you want 20 staff, you want a big office on the high street, you want this. He said, it doesn't work like that, Francis. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've got a support worker who helps me in the office, and it's only me, and we've got a small office. You know, our budget is like £80,000 a year. What you just giving me, your business plan, is like £500,000. Who's going to give you £500,000? The lottery?
Yeah.
He said, it doesn't work like that.
Either by grant or by winning.
Yeah. And he just bid it. He said, nah, let's start again. And he gave me a copy of his business plan. So go and read my business plan and use that as a start and just write over it. I did that. I went back to him again. He goes, okay, I'm going to take you to the Tudor Trust. I know the CEO, Christopher.
And they were one of your early funders, weren't they?
They kickstart us. So Ian introduced us.
Mm.
And Ian said, I know the Tudor Trust. They've been funding me every single year without any gaps. So if I recommend a charity, 95% they'll fund it if I recommend a charity to them.
Subject to proper accountability and scrutiny, of course.
Yeah, but yeah.
It's good to have those links, though, isn't
it? It's good to have those links. Yeah, yeah. And then he did the whole application. So I'll do the application form. I'll do the bid. I'll do everything for you. You put it in and Tudor Trust invited me in to meet their board. And Ian said, right now, Francis, you're on your own. I've got you in there. Now you have to go and sell yourself like dragons then. And I went in, I did that. A week later they wrote to me, so right, we're going to give you £60,000 to kickstart Reform, Restore, Respect. And then they fell out of my chair. So wow. And that was the start of it. And then it just grown and grown and grown. I can easily even do it full time and just step down from my role at Westheath. But my board will not allow me to. But they said the charitable world, the voluntary sector is very fierce.
Yeah.
You know, when funding is good, it's good, it's coming in. But it's a Francis, you got mortgage, you got family, we don't need to rely on it.
Mm.
So we want you to hold on to your full time post at a school, and you're using your degree as well. So that we know that will pay your mortgage and all of that. Reform, Restore, Respect is your passion. You've got raw passion for it, and you believe in it, like you love football. So do that part time and job share. So do schools at least 2 days a week you've been in school and do it like that. So at least you're getting best of both job roles, and they've stuck to that up to now. Every time I mention, can I go full time, they always chat me down. Nope, you're going to do it part time. You're going to do 2 schools a week.
I'll just have to clone you instead, you know.
Yeah,
get a second.
So that's how it started.
There's a new way to report non-emergency incidents or crimes to Kent Police. So if you've seen or been in a... or you've been a victim of a maybe your has gone. You can report it online at kent.police.uk/contact. It's quick, simple, and you reach the same people as calling our non-emergency line. Click before you call. Kent Police. Protecting and serving the people of Kent.
You've touched the lives of hundreds of thousands of kids along the way. And we were talking before this about some of the feedback forms that you've been getting from the kids in the schools. You know, what impact does that have on you when you see the feedback you're getting? What, you know, what is the feedback that you're getting from the schools?
I always analyse them and I read every single one. Sometimes I even get letters. The children will go out of their way and write letters. I have 20 letters written to me in the post of how much I've touched them and what they got out of the talk. And I sit down and I read them and it just makes me, it gives me a sense of pride. Like, wow. And I'm touching, making this impact on children. And that's exactly what I wanted. Because when I set the charity up, yes, it's my passion. But I felt the way I got involved in crime was very short-lived. It all happened very quick. And if I had somebody come to my Roman Catholic school in Wood Green in North London, like what I'm doing, to do an assembly for me at year 7, year 8, year 9, year 10, I think that would be enough to save me. So when Mark Lambie, the gang leaders, groomed me, I'd be aware of all those signs that he got plans for me to stay clear of him. And I wasn't streetwise at all. So I felt if I can do what I'm doing now, because I missed it, I can save lives. And that's how the whole thing came about. And I've seen Ian deliver his in prisons, and I felt this guy is great. He's a great talker, motivational speaker, but he hasn't even got a criminal record. He's never been in trouble, you know. He's just talking from books, newspapers, you know. I said I can do this better than him, and he's coming and watch me in a few schools across Kent, and he was like, Francis, you are better than me.
that's good feedback. You know, so experienced, give that feedback, and you know, the enthusiasm always comes across when we talk about how passionate you are about this. But I mean, I think going back to the point that you made about, you know, no one spotted the signs within the 18 months that you started to get involved. Yeah. Put that to the one side, because obviously that was 16 years ago now. Yeah. That was, you know, we had, you know, that was the era of tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, and the growth of Sure Start and investment in schools.
Labour Party.
A lot of things, well, I wasn't going to be political, but, you know, a lot of things, you know, a lot of investment was going into those kind of things, and yet those things still happened. Are the agencies today doing enough, do you feel, in order to try and tackle these issues, whether it is through interaction with children or whether it is through interaction with parents? You know, could you say the last 10 years of austerity and changes to policing the public sector, have they knocked that impact? You know, what's your view?
My view, and putting my Secretary of State hat on, I really struggle with this element of it. I feel central government, what's going on in the news, the stabbing, the murder rate in London and all of that, I think they are being reactive and they throw lots of millions of pounds at it. But these millions of pounds, the people on the grassroots who I feel actually do the work and can make the impact, they don't get a sniff of this funding. The funding goes to big nationwide charities who I normally quite refer to in conference as the big sharks. You know, the G4Ss and people like these big corporate people, they make a bid because they know how to make a bid to government to get these millions of pounds of the government. And all they do is subcontract and subcontract to other people. And the work get lost. It doesn't get achieved. And I really struggle with government wasting money like that. And in essence, that is the difference. And I'm not bigging you up because you give us funding. That is the difference between you as a PCC.
That local responsibility, that local accountability.
You put yourself about, you're speaking to the community, you're speaking to voluntary sectors, charities, and you are bringing everyone to the table. And that's what main government need to do. And they don't do that. They just give millions and millions of pounds, they pledge and give it to these big corporate companies, but they're not delivering nothing. They just take this money from government. And these are taxpayers' money. And it's not fair.
Do you think that the serious violence strategy improves upon that, because within that we've got this idea of the Youth Endowment Fund and the Early Intervention Fund. Do you think by disseminating those down to more locally through PCCs and councils has been a better approach than maybe what they've been doing in recent years?
Absolutely, that? And that's what needs to happen. That's exactly what needs to happen. I mean, I've had a call from Police Sergeant Sasha Bloomfield, Medway Task Force. We're going to have the Medway Task Force, like the Margate one, and she's sort of taking that on. She called me straight away. Francis, we want to partner with you. We want you involved in this. We want,
brilliant,
you know, we want you to get you into Medway schools, and that's how the work get done. Because I think these voluntary sectors got a massive role to play. These charities and all of that, you know, they got a massive role to play, and they're the one that do the work. They understand what's going on locally, on the street level. They know more, but they keep their ears to the street and they understand the kids and these issues. But these big corporate ones, for me, and that is the difference between you and what they're doing in government.
To any parents who might be listening to this, obviously, you know, what would you say as a parent yourself now to other parents? What, if any, warning signs should they be looking out for in their own children who may be at risk of, maybe on the fringes, or maybe have concerns about their children getting involved in drugs and with gangs and with violence?
My message to any parent will be, look out for the signs. The signs sometimes could be normal teenage behaviour signs. You know, all teenagers go through adolescence and display certain signs, you know, attitude. But sometimes where there's so many of these signs, it's not just a coincidence. There's more to it than that. So if your child's coming home and they've got two or three mobile phones, no, question that. They don't work. You know, I've got my personal phone, I've got a school phone, I hold two phones because I work, I'm a professional. But why as a child, why has a teenager got two or three phones? Question that. What is going on? Are you finding a quantity of money or sum of money in their bedroom? And are they wearing a lot of expensive clothing and they don't work? You know, we buy them their clothes, but now they're wearing designer clothing. Are you finding bruises on them? There's a lot of signs that parents can spot. Don't be ashamed as a parent. Speak to schools. Speak to the school DSL, the designated safeguarding leads. Share that information with the schools. Work with them. You know, if external agencies or charities or voluntary sectors are going into your kid's school to do such work around knife crime, gangs, please support the school. You know, support the school. Because it's very important. It's early intervention. It's education for your child. Knowledge is power. And that's, you know, some parents will say, no, we don't want that for our kids. Please get behind your schools. So some schools are really good schools. They're very proactive. And they've got your child's best interests at heart. And that's what I'll say to a parent.
One final question, which I gave you pre-warning of, so you had a chance to think about.
Yeah.
We've got a leadership election going on at the moment. We have a new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt. They're looking for a new Home Secretary, and they've asked you to be Home Secretary for a day.
Okay.
If you were Home Secretary for a day, what would you change? What would you improve? How would you do things differently? What would your message be?
I will really get behind PCCs. And again, I'm not saying that because Matthew's here. I mean, he's really set the bar high in Kent, where a lot of pieces need to follow what he's doing. This violence reduction challenge piece of work has been a massive piece of work, but Kent is leading the way on that. You know, I mean, we had Victoria Atkins attend our summit, and she even commented on that. We are leading the way on that. And I think, as a Home Secretary, if I was, I'm all about early intervention. I'm a great believer in early intervention. It costs less in the long run to taxpayers' money. You know, we're not building any more prisons. It costs £80,000 and £90,000 to keep a young person in prison for 1 year. That's a lot of money to taxpayer. Let's use early intervention. Let's stop them in the first place before they get in there. So as Home Secretary, I'll be really concentrated on early intervention. It's massive. And that's getting schools involved, probation, yacht, everyone. And I was singing from the same hymn book. And I'll put a lot of energy into that. I'm a great believer of early intervention.
Superb. If people want to find out more about your charity and your work, where can they look? Where can they find it?
You can just Google Reform, Restore, Respect. I think we had the first hit on Google because so many schools go on there that it's put our ratings up on Google.
Very good.
You will find us. You can find us on Twitter. We've got a Facebook page as well. You know, every school we go into, we all tweeting. We're not hard to find. be the first hit on Google. Just Google Reform, Restore Respect, it will bring the website up.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about this podcast at matthewscott.org.uk. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube. You can also find this podcast on Apple, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Acast, and wherever you can download podcasts.